Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk, dissect, and review work life in the networking industry. This week, the virtual workbench has been instantiated in an office overlooking a paddock in London. It's looking nice, but it definitely looks like the walls have made us servers, wall-to-wall servers. And that's because I've invited Daniel Bowers, who is a senior analyst from Ideas International, to come and talk to me today. Welcome, Daniel.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me on here.
Hey, no problems at all. It's good to talk to you again after we met up a couple of years back. We've been promising to do this for a while, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. It was, Copenhagen at VMworld Europe a couple of years ago when we first hooked up.
We did.
Yep.
Now, tell people a little bit about what you do as an analyst.
Okay. I'm a server guy. As an analyst, I spend almost all of my time on servers and server performance, server comparisons. And then Ideas, a company I work for, is an analyst company that does a lot of tools to do server and actually storage and vendor services analysis and to do a lot of those comparison kind of stuff. So I tend to do a lot of stuff around research on server performance, both x86 as well as non-x86 as the RISC and the Itanium-based server kind of stuff.
Cool. So we were having a debate, as I remember it, about how network performance is impacted by server architectures and what goes on inside a server. So sometimes networking takes a view that a Intel server is really just a bunch of mice, you know, grinding away on the wheel, and every now and then a packet ejects from, you know.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to do was have a brief discussion, sort of just talking over some of the broad issues that maybe a networking guy would like to know about server architectures and how they work. And so Daniel, being as he spends his time wondering about such topics in detail, would seem to be the obvious person to talk to about it. So let's kick off the discussion with network performance. So in every server, there's a NIC, right? And most servers come with a bog standard, like an Intel adapter or an Intel chipset or a Broadcom chipset. But what is it that affects the performance of that NIC in the system?
Well, yeah, almost all servers have NICs, and we're starting to transition from the speeds from a 1 gigabit NIC to a 10 gigabit NIC or something like that. But from a server perspective, that NIC is almost like the endpoint. A server is set up almost like an org chart where you've got the CPU, and the CPU is kind of the king or the emperor. And then spread down from that like an org chart, it might go through a couple of layers, but down those little end nodes are the individual NICs. So there's a bunch of places that performance can be impacted. But down at the NIC level, there's been a lot of changes over the past 10 years as the vendors, the NIC vendors and the server vendors have tried to improve the performance down level, especially to account for virtualization. So they've started making NICs that are much more smart, that begin to bring offload features like tow offload and DMA and that kind of stuff. And it's primarily to help that data flow, the bandwidth, from that top of the org chart, the CPU area, down to the bottom, that NIC area. So it's almost exclusively improving the performance, this north-south.
Okay, so north-south in a server is CPU to the NIC. Because if I think of a server architecture, I always think of it as made up of really four different things. There's CPU to memory architectures, then there's CPU to the bus, and on the bus is the NICs, and the NICs break down into two, HBAs and CNAs these days. But the network adapter actually sits across the bus. It doesn't normally direct connect to the CPU like memory does. Is that fair?
Yeah, and that's critical right there. There is a bus. The type of bus that's been in a server has changed over the past 10 years, though. It used to truly be a bus. All the devices would sit on the bus, and the servers would sit on the bus, and they'd share that. You know, one would talk at a time on that bus. But now there's a lot more point-to-point connections. So even to the point where there are point-to-point connections between a CPU and down to a NIC level.
Right.
So it's changed from a bus concept, but still basically you've got that same idea.
So conceptually, you just sort of have the CPU and it has an I/O architecture, which it goes out to all the I/O modules. Now, the I/O modules might be network adapters, video displays, keyboards, although they have less relevance in a server architecture, they still have to be there to be able to display screens, even if it's a remote screen, although even in I/O. But, you know, all those types of things are there. But you're saying that the bus itself might actually be of multiple parts.
Yeah, so and I take the example of a modern server, and all my examples, I think I'm just going to be talking about an x86 server, something using an Intel Xeon processor. It's based on the current one. They'll have processors there'll be some kind of I/O hub that the processors talk to. So there is like that central point of connection. But from there, there are point-to-point connections from that central I/O hub down to the individual devices, whether it's an embedded NIC or a plug-in NIC or the video controller or those kind of things. Okay. Those point-to-point connections between that I/O hub and the NICs are usually PCI Express lanes. So right. PCI Express, what used to be the PCI bus, which was a shared bus, has now evolved into point-to-point PCI Express connections.
Okay, so that's part of the reason why network adapters can now drive 10 gigabits per second.
Yeah, those individual connections, those PCI Express connections, now have enough bandwidth that they can handle 10 gigabit connections, and in some cases more than that. But PCI Express, because it's a point-to-point connection, has a bandwidth limit. And the way that works inside the server is that it's determined by the width of the PCI connection. And that's measured in terms of the number of lanes. So you might hear, you see on the server specs, things like a by 4 PCI Express connection. That by 4 just means there are four lanes. And each
are
lane...
Are they tracks on the motherboard, or are they four point-to-point gateways? So they just...
They're actually tracks on the motherboard. They're actually
bits of copper print. Yeah.
Copper lanes on the motherboard that go from that I/O hub or from whatever device it is to the NIC.
Right. And so if you've got just like on a switchback plane, you can have multiple I/O channels. So for example, a Cisco 6500, which most people will be listening to, there's two lanes to each line card. Each one's 20 gigabits per second for a total of 40. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly like that.
Conceptually, they're similar. All right. Cool.
Today, a PCI Express lane is about 4 gigabits per second of data.
Okay.
And most connections are usually either 4 lanes or 8 lanes. So you can see, just do the math, a 4-lane connection, each lane running at 4 gigabits per second, that's, you know, in theory, 16 gigabits a second of data, which should be enough for one-way 10 gigabit throughput.
Okay. So... bus performance varies according to, so PCIX is the current one, and then the number of lanes, usually 4 or 8 lanes, and each one's about approximately 4 gigabits per second per. So yep. That's the data coming off the CPU, crosses the bus down to the NIC. Now, I want to come back to the NIC again, because my understanding is that NIC adapters today are actually much more, in the old days, it was the CPU that actually did the TCP/IP. So when a TCP/IP packet comes out of the CPU, it actually has to be encapsulated and has a CRC check done, and that was done in the Intel. But these days we have things called HBAs or CNAs, which are basically a NIC with a computer on board or a CPU or a chip that's optimized to do the TCP/IP processing. Is that fundamentally correct?
Yeah, it is, and it's also pretty critical. In order to get anywhere near line rate bandwidth, you pretty much have to offload, that is, move a lot of those TCP/IP, you know, calculations and setting up connections. You have to get that away from the CPU and get it closer to the network device. And so they put it on a little controller that's on the NIC. So the NIC itself has a little controller. It's got memory. It's its own little system. So it can do all those calculations. So it doesn't have to depend on the CPU.
But that chip can now be optimized for task, like an Intel CPU is a sort of a general purpose type thing. It does everything badly, if you like. Intel probably wouldn't like that viewpoint, but the Intel CPU doesn't do anything particularly well. It does everything pretty well, good enough.
Yeah.
Whereas the chip that goes onto a converged network adapter is optimized, custom built, the silicon just there to do the TCP/IP functions, the segmentation of the data flow, chops it up into chunks, straps a TCP/IP header, and then calculates the CRC and then shunts it out the card.
Absolutely. And it's because, like you just said, a CPU could do that in theory. Years ago, it used to do that, but it's not optimized for it. Mm-hmm. And so you want optimized hardware to do that, which is why you've got basically what custom devices on those NICs, custom ASICs on those NICs that can handle either the TCP/IP offload or the DMA and the various flavors of DMA. And now that we get into CNA, that can do some of the converged networking kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's where this fiber channel over Ethernet and all that type of stuff comes from, because the CNA is actually a very intelligent NIC. It's not just not only is it with a CPU, it actually does the whole fiber channel to fiber channel over Ethernet conversion and then runs the signaling layer out into the network that FCOE needs. It has to talk to the FCFs and perform the B2B credits and all that sort of stuff. So they're far more sophisticated, as I understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's still possible to do that stuff in the CPU if you wanted to. Like Intel themselves have a software stack that allows you the processor to do some of that fiber channel encoding when it's going to go out of fiber channel over Ethernet. But it's slower, you know, because it's not as optimized. You're running on general purpose CPUs rather
running
than
running it back on your Intel cores. A little bit of demand side generation. It wouldn't suit Intel at all, would it, to be? So there's one other thing that I seem to remember a server guy telling me about, that was memory performance. Because in the old days, when a packet shifted out of the CPU, it would go the memory read to the CPU and back again is critical. Because in the old days, you used to get I/O performance, you'd read from the memory into the CPU and then back to the memory, and then from the memory back out to the network adapter. And the TCP/IP and the CRC stacks would all be calced. So memory performance today, how does that look? What does that look like?
Obviously, memory performance has gotten a lot fatter, a lot bigger, a lot more memory performance. But there's still a fundamental dependency on memory performance. And by that, I mean the amount of bytes that you can transfer between main memory and the CPU and your ability to hit line rate on a NIC. But that connection isn't obvious. At least it might not be obvious to Network Guy why the NIC throughput, why the NIC performance is going to depend on that memory bandwidth. And it's because whenever a byte is going to go out on the network, that byte's got to be processed, read from memory, and written back to memory, transferred between a virtual machine layer and hypervisor layer. It actually isn't just written or read once. It might be written or read 4, 5, 6, 7 times before it actually gets down and it's ready to push down one of those PCI Express lanes and get to the NIC and send out the network port. So there's like a multiple. If you want to, you know, have a throughput of a gigabit per second on your NIC, in order to feed that, you're going to have a multiple of a gigabit per second memory bandwidth, because you're going to be reading and writing those bytes a lot between the CPU and main memory. And that's the connection that still exists. And that connection, that memory bandwidth, is something that sometimes people run into when they're trying to run a 10 gigabit NIC at line rate. They realize they can't, and they're trying to figure it out. And one of those reasons is memory bandwidth, which, again, from the outset, doesn't seem like an obvious reason why you wouldn't be able to hit line rate on a NIC.
Yeah. So the memory architecture is important. It, obviously, in terms of just straight line processing speed for the operating system, you know, Windows, Linux, whatever it is. But it also has a direct impact on the network I/O performance, because data gets read, CPU memory, CPU memory, memory, CPU, and then finally gets forwarded out to the NIC to be munged into a network frame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and it's gotten worse, I guess, because it used to be, you know, if you want more memory bandwidth, you buy faster memory, or you just buy more memory. But now, with modern Intel Xeon processors and their Opteron equivalents from AMD, it's not obvious whether you've got good or optimal memory bandwidth just by looking at a server. It's going to depend on what processor model you buy, what type of DIMMs you buy, and where you stick them in the system. All those things together, and how many DIMMs you use, all those things together are going to determine how much memory bandwidth you actually have. Like I said, it's not obvious just by looking at the server how much you have. You actually have to dig into these vendor spreadsheet or vendor spec lists and look at the parts closely to kind of figure it out.
Yeah, and I've tried to figure it out a few times, and it's not, well, it's just not obvious. I mean, there's no benchmark, there's no standard, there's no this is a this type server and it has this much performance. You know, at least with the words 10 gigabit Ethernet, you know what it does. Intel calls their servers, you know, the ARF, or what's sort of the naming convention is like an Intel 5520 or a 3420 or an E7510. What does that tell you about it? Absolutely.
Yeah,
nothing.
And it doesn't. And even if you can figure out what the right points are, you're still going to have to look up in the spec sheets, because just give an example, Intel might have 10 or 15 different processors that are considered within the same family. So they have model numbers that look similar to each other. But within those models, they're going to have different characteristics, and some are going to have higher memory bandwidth than others. It didn't used to be that way, but now down at the model level, it is. So, you know, even what all digits are in the model number of your CPU might determine whether or not you're going to be able to hit line rate on a 10 gig NIC.
Yeah, well, so I'm looking at the moment at an article on ntop.org. They produce a memory a network analyzer sort of thing that actually counts every single packet. And their challenge has been to build a 10 gigabit per second software driver for a Linux interface to run like top does in Linux. So you can just see what's the top packets of on a link. And they're putting up some posts here on some testing they've done, and there's an Intel 55, a Dell 710, a Dell 510, and a Dell 310. They use an Intel 5520 in some of those, and they can vary from 7.7 gigabits per second of memory bandwidth up to 12.1 gigabits per second to 9 gigabits per second, all for the same CPU or the same chipset.
Yeah, and
not CPU, chipset. They've got the same chipset, but different CPUs. Yeah,
it's going to vary depending on the CPU as to how much memory bandwidth you're going to get. Also, it's going to vary how much memory bandwidth you get depending on how much memory you have in the system and where you stick it in the system. So, example, you might have a whole bunch of DIMM slots. If you fill all those DIMM slots up, you might actually have lower memory bandwidth than if you only put DIMMs in a few select slots.
Right.
That's something that's not obvious, and it's something that you really have to dig into block diagrams from these server vendors to figure out, okay, how am I going to max my memory bandwidth?
Yeah. Well, I found this really interesting, this article here, because he does some tests on some Supermicros, and I'll have a link in the show notes, using Xeon, and he's talking about the Supermicros having something like 2 to 3 times the same performance, 2 to 3 times the performance in terms of memory bandwidth than from Dell's that he tested. Which is staggering. I mean, you're talking 34 gigabits per second versus, some of the Dells, obviously some of the low-end ones, but I'll use it as a radical example, only 6 gigabits per second. That's almost 6 times, 600% difference.
Yeah, and I think it's gonna turn out to be a lot of configuration difference, like physically what's in those servers and what style of DIMMs are being used and that kind of stuff. Because between two x86-based servers using the same processor, if they're using the same processor with the same chipset, as long as you use the same combination of memory and DIMMs and stuff like that, you'll see ballpark the same performance. So, yeah, it is eye-opening to see some of the differences, and
sure.
I think a lot of it has to do with the configuration differences.
Okay, so as networking guys, probably what do we need to know? We need to know that things are CPU dependent, but the same CPU in a chassis depends on the memory that it's used. It'll also depend on the chipset that the CPU is attached to. So you could have the same E5520 chipset and have a different CPU, or you could have the same CPU and different chipsets, which then defines the memory performance and the bus performance normally as well. The chipset defines the bus performance.
Yeah, and speaking about that bus performance, there's something else that's has a big impact here. We talked about the bus and how modern servers use PCI Express lanes and whatnot. It's not always obvious if you've got a server that's got a bunch of empty PCI Express slots, which physical slots are actually going to give you enough or good bandwidth. Because not all slots are going to be identical. They're not all going to have the same number of lanes. They're not all going to connect the same place. So, again, it's something that you've got to dig down into the specs and figure out, hey, you might actually have more bandwidth if you stick your 10-gig card in slot A versus slot B.
Okay. Wow. Ooh. So now the classic application I'm thinking of here is low-latency networking or high-performance networking for those people who are doing it. And extracting milliseconds of performance comes down to having all of these things in sync. Now, I'm not even going to get into testing server stuff because that's really server guy things. But if you're a networking guy and people say, why is your network not running at speed? You need to be asking, what have they done to optimize the server architecture? And my goal was to sort of talk a little bit about these things. Now, there's one other thing to talk about here is in terms of your NICs, there are companies out there who make specialist NICs for high performance acceleration, and they are people like Mellanox and QLogix makes some as well. Have you done much of looking at those NIC architectures, or is that just something that I know about because I'm a networking guy?
Are you talking along the 10 gig NICs or the combination 10 gig NICs and InfiniBand NICs?
Well, obviously, InfiniBand and Ethernet are two different types of NICs, and InfiniBand works much faster than Ethernet because it doesn't it does RDMA. Remote DMA, doesn't it? So you're basically writing from one memory location in an operating system to another memory location. It can be used as a networking protocol, but it's much more efficient because it doesn't have to encapsulate it in a packet. InfiniBand doesn't route as such. It's more of an I/O channel.
It is. You can see it used in a lot of places, though, where they want to try to hit those high speed rates. And part of it is just because you said that their version of their RDMA. Allows you to move a lot of those bits and bytes you know, out of the physical HBA and into memory or over to another HBA without having to involve the CPU. And again, every time you hit the CPU, not only are you going to use up CPU cycles, which isn't so bad, but you're also going to get memory. More dependent on memory bandwidth.
Yeah, and latency as it goes from CPU to memory, memory to CPU, and so forth.
Yep.
RDMA abolishes that latency that is normally done with network drivers. Now, one other thing to say is, although we're focusing here on hardware, there's also the network adapter driver, the actual software that defines, you can have the fanciest NIC in the world, but if you don't have the driver with the features turned on that enable those, it'll just run slow.
Yeah, that's true. And it's compounded by virtualization. It's compounded by when you throw VMware or Hyper-V or something like that onto an x86 server, now that driver is actually kind of a two-part driver. There's a driver in the hypervisor, mm-hmm. and there's a driver in the virtual machine. So now you've kind of got two drivers to worry about, or two levels to worry about. And it generally, that kind of architecture, you've abstracted the NIC so much that you've kind of lost that direct connection between the CPU and the NIC. So right. you've introduced latency there, which is why a lot of the changes going on in drivers and in hypervisors have been getting rid of that latency by reestablishing that direct connection between the CPU and a NIC by doing things like VM Direct Path. Or VMDQs in NICs. The only other thing I wanted to mention was is a interesting reason that you can just say that servers don't make good switches. You can stick a bunch of NIC cards in there. You could try to run them at line rate. You might be able to get 5 or 6 10 gig NIC cards running at line rate if you wrote the right test to do it. But servers don't make good switches. One, because that north-south problem that you've got. But also, every time you do something with a packet, if you want to rip that packet open and inspect it for a firewall or whatnot, it's got to be done by the CPU, which means every time you want to do an additional thing to that packet, even if it's something that can be done simple in an ASIC that's on a dedicated switch and a custom ASIC, it's hard to do that, or it takes cycles to do that. And it's not that you don't have the cycles available in a modern CPU. You've got plenty of cycles available. It's just the latency, because you've got to get stuff up to the CPU, let it run its code, and return it back down. It's the latency that kills you.
I also felt that software switching has a fatal flaw around not only latency, but your networking load is going to spike at the same time as your processing load. There's a direct linkage between how much data you want to move across the network interface as the data that you want to process in band. So if you've got a web server and it's starting to process a data load, it's also at maximum network node. So you're actually peaking on a peak.
Yeah, and you also tend to throw more workloads onto that CPU. If you've got a web server, that web server tends to be generating log files. So at the same time you're trying to push all this traffic to the NIC, you're also probably pushing traffic to the storage controller, the local storage controller, to do the log files.
And the network interface card is receiving more data, and so you get this cumulative. Now, that peak might only happen for, 500 milliseconds, but the height of that peak is it goes right up. It's cumulative. All of those things are running on the same, and the CPU becomes bound, becomes the point of failure.
Well, yeah, and I wouldn't say so much the CPU comes back. It becomes a bottleneck. But a lot of reason that CPU becomes a bottleneck goes back to that memory bandwidth. We've got more CPU cycles than you know what to do with. You could handle the creating the TCP/IP headers and establishing the connections and all that kind of stuff. You could handle all that in one core of a modern 8-core processor. But that's going to suck away all your memory bandwidth. That's where the bottleneck is going to come in that CPU area. And especially modern CPUs where the memory directly attaches to the CPU.
You're saying the other 7 CPUs would be starved for access to the memory?
Yeah, exactly.
So you could have 16 CPUs, 32 of them, unless the memory architecture's unbound or not unthrottled. You can't read and write to the memory because the networking stack is driving it so hard.
Yeah.
I always said software switching is limited. I don't think it's ever going to work.
It works in some places. Like if you're doing your, obviously your home lab and you're switching 1 gigabit, that's not going to be a problem. But a modern server has two problems. One, it doesn't have a fabric. It doesn't have direct connection from NIC 1 to NIC 2. It's got to go up north to the CPU first, and that is going to kill your throughput if you really wanted to run a switch kind of software on there.
Yeah, no, I get that. I get that. I mean, I can see what they're trying to achieve. What they're trying to say is commodity hardware. You can get an Intel server and you can run a software switch in there and it should be cheaper than using a custom switch. But I'm not sure that it's a structural. I think it's more of an edge case, not a core case.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And when you take a look at a Nexus, it's got a commodity processor in there. You know, Nexus will have a Xeon dual core x86 processor in there, but it's strictly on the control plane. It's not the fabric. You know, it's not controlling those bytes as they flow from port to port. It's strictly on the control layer. But that, I think, sometimes misleads people into thinking, hey, I could just, you know, throw a software stack onto my x86 server and make it a good switch.
Okay. Well, Dan, thanks very much for running over that for me. I think I've got a better idea. I've learned quite a lot about buses and memory architectures. And that's it for the show this week. And thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Daniel Bowers for joining us this week. Daniel, where can people find you on the internet?
Greg, thanks. You can reach me on Twitter. I am Daniel_Bowers on Twitter. Or hit me on my website and my blog at ideasinternational.com.
Fantastic. And I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter as @etherealmind. As always, love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave a comment on today's show or follow us on Twitter as @packetpushers. And thanks, Dan, for taking the time to come on the show and be nerdy. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.